Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few riders who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
All right. Live from the gleaming, streamlined, state-of-the-art studios of OutlawRadioLive.com, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area. Following program is produced with an artistic vengeance by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. True Crime Uncensored. I remain. I looked and saw it was true. The legendary Burl Bear. Man over there, that's Mark C.G. Boyer, fact checker co-host. And we have once again with us, because she was in the neighborhood and we cast out a tuna and brought her right in, Lisa Mia, author of Juliet Lives. And joining us on the phone is a inspirational person who changed Lisa's life by lending her $5 and sending her to Taco Bell. It's Elena Ferguson. Elena, are you still there?
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're fun to be had. Please don't use the speakerphone, though. Just hold that phone up to your face, and a lovely face it is.
How about that?
That's much better. You have won more awards than most authors I know, including the Hoosier Award. I don't know how one becomes a Hoosier, but...
I know.
Well, you play basketball for a college.
Okay. Well, congratulations on your great basketball record.
Yeah. I slipped that right in. And would you tell Lisa and Mia I still need that $5?
Yeah, she still wants that $5 back, Lisa.
Oh, I don't know if I can... I still need to get some more time to get that $5. I got $4. I managed to get $4.
Well, you can sell it to her.
I can sell you the $4.
I'll quote you the $1. Yeah.
Okay. Meanwhile, you also have won the Edgar Award, which we discussed privately. What a thrill that was. You've also been nominated about 3 more times.
And been a judge, which is really a thrill.
Yeah, and you won something from the New York Public Library. I think it was they forgave your debts on the books you checked out and didn't bring back.
Right on my shelf.
Yeah, still got them. You know, my brother went back to Walla Walla, Washington from Seattle, and he went to the library to do some research. He decided to check out a book, and he owed him $350 from high school.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, that's show business. Well, getting back to the whole topic of true crime, in addition to having won all these great awards and being a famous author, along with your mom, on more books that I've written, I think, if you had these up, so that makes me a certain degree professional jealousy. You also had a tragic experience of having one of your close personal friends murdered, which must have had an effect. Had an effect on your life.
Yes. Can you? It changed my life from before she died to after she died.
Okay. Could you go back and recount that for us from your personal experience so we know what we're talking about here?
Well, she and I were best friends. We were in pep club together. We did everything together. And I got a call when I was visiting my sister. And I found out that she had been found murdered. And I was in absolute shock. I wasn't sure it was true. I called her father, and he answered in such a calm manner that I thought surely I had the facts wrong. Because I said, I'm so sorry. I just heard something had happened to Savannah. And he said, it did. And I paused, and I said, well, I heard she's dead. And he said, yes, she is. She was murdered, and I just fell to my knees. I just dropped down. I couldn't believe it. She and I were so, so close. And when it continued on, the facts came out. I was flown down to California because I'd been with her recently, and I was in Utah at the time, and I could remember all the restaurants we'd been to, where we'd been to the beach together. And it was very difficult for me to think that somebody had stolen her life, because she was so beautiful and so vibrant and very, very intelligent. But we did not know who had done it, and that's its own kind of torture. She had been found on her bed. She had been bludgeoned, so I heard that if she hadn't died from her strangulation, manual strangulation, she would have died from the head wounds. She was hit with something very, very hard, viciously beaten. Her teeth were broken. Her jaw was broken. She was found in a tremendous amount of blood. But I knew that there was something very weird when I talked to the detective, and they were trying to piece together what had happened to her after her death, because she had been apparently dragged into her bathroom and washed and then returned back to her bed. So they had a very funky timeline going on. And her jewelry was also put on, and they knew this because her necklace was attached in the front, not in the back, and she'd just gone through a vicious attack, and it was very clean, and the watch was not buckled up. And so we went through and visited all the places she had been, but we came up with nothing. And I say we because I was felt very close to the police, Ron Veach, Barry Montgomery, Gary Payne, and Scott Cade, trying very hard to piece together any kind of encounter she had made us have with somebody, even at a gas station. I mean, we literally retraced everything. And so in her case, her boyfriend named Bill Mills, they'd just barely gotten engaged, had called the police, and they had tried to get in, and then they broke in through a window that was already open. They were pretty sure that's how the person had gotten in. And so they went through, and on the assumption that it was a break-in, more or less, I found nothing because this was pre-DNA, and because everything had been wiped up and wiped down, her blood was smeared all over the place. But they didn't have much to go on until they discovered a bloody palm print left on a door jamb. When he had dragged her body in from the bedroom into the bathroom, he left a palm print, and that was in blood. So they knew they could have their man if they could find their man. But
this was pre-DNA.
Nobody matched, and they did try hundreds of people, including the two security guards that were on duty, Chuck Doyle and Robert Lloyd Sellers. Robert Sellers was the daytime security. Chuck Doyle came in at night. And so they had to clear everyone, and this went dormant for a really long time until Larry Montgomery pulled everything out again and we looked at it and realized they'd made an error, which shocked me because I didn't think in something this serious you could make an error. They misread the bloody palm print, and the perpetrator was indeed Robert Lloyd Sellers.
It took several years. Did it take several years to get to this point?
So we do know that it was him. For a while, they believed he was the killer of Savannah. Was called the Bedroom Basher in Irvine. There was in that area, but that actually I found out much later in 1996. That turned out to be a man called Gerald Parker. But for a long time, I had said serial killer because that's what had been told to me, that they thought this was a serial killer. When he was on the stand, Robert Lloyd Seller wasn't on the stand, he was interviewed. He said that he had been really infatuated with Savannah, and when he tried to say he wanted a relationship, she turned him down and she flew into a rage. So I was testified at the trial, and I got to stare him right in the eye, knowing what he had done. I knew his defense was very strange. It was sort of you're familiar with the Twinkie defense. It was sort of one that was
right. Yeah.
Like a generation off, which was he was really, really tired, and mm-hmm. that's why he did it. So, didn't really go for that one. But he was found guilty and sentenced to first-degree murder with special circumstances. That was in November 1986. So we have quite a time because she was killed in May 14th, 1979. So that's when she died, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, is what they're thinking. So it took a while to catch him, and I was looking around thinking everyone was the killer. But the worst part was it left her parents, Alan Maxine Anderson, completely devastated. He might as well have told them to while he was at it. I don't think people really understand what happens to families when somebody is killed and taken out of their lives so dramatically and so harshly. It ripples and ripples and ripples and ripples, and they were just felled by what happened to Savannah. She was gone, their only child. They sort of froze their house. Nothing changed. The carpet remained the same. Her bedroom is exactly the same. She had only been there for a short while, actually only in the apartment for probably, I think it was 6 weeks or so, in the Woodbridge apartment before he, the security guard, decided to take her for himself. And that's basically the story of what happened to her. I was thrilled when they caught him. I was euphoric when he was found guilty, devastated when they overturned it on a technicality, which was a very odd one for me anyway. The technicality was because of the story being so strange that Sellers had.
Well, there was the unusual or extenuating circumstance was that supposedly he had raped her in addition to having murdered her. But what turns out is that he had sex with her after she was dead.
So he says.
Yes.
So that's a different timeline.
He killed her. He left. He got caught, you know, skulking around by Chuck Doyle, who forgot to mention that Sellers had his shirt off and he was wearing a T-shirt, but his shirt was all bunched up. He goes, "Yeah, let's go out to breakfast." Then after breakfast, he came back. And that's where he said that he did this up high on methamphetamines, completely out of his mind, rape of her. However, I don't think the way that he staged the body, at least from my looking at the scene and what I think may have happened, the defense that he was crazy on drugs doesn't make sense or match up to me with how methodical he was. But that's what the story was. So that what the case came down to was her heart beating when he raped her? Or was it not beating, just an abuse of a corpse, and therefore he could not have been charged because of the amount of time that had gone by? So that's sort of a nutshell of what happened. But it's nothing to the devastation that happened after she was taken. And I've been dealing with it ever since, mostly in my work as a writer. As you can see, I write mysteries, and I can control that end. I can make that happy. So at least justice.
Yeah, I notice you've written a series of young adult books that deal with forensic evidence.
Yes.
And that's probably the reason why, the motivation behind that?
It was, especially in the trial. When they were going out for the second trial, they'd lost the trachea, which proved strangulation. And I could not imagine how anyone could lose a trachea. So I started doing deep dives into how the process really works behind the scenes, and it's nothing like TV. It's an art. It's messy. It's tough. There are not enough people that will do it. And things like misplacing evidence is not at all uncommon.
Not at all.
But I got so fascinated by this process that I began to write about it.
Well, that's good therapy for you and good for those who read your books. I noticed there's a category, and I was unaware of this until today, that there is a category for reluctant readers.
Yes.
Can you explain that a bit?
Well, unfortunately, there's 1,000 reasons why people will tell you this, but the reader, the attention to detail, the attention to actually get through a book has waned as we've gone into all kinds of video games. We have very much of a problem getting male young men wanting to read novels. And they don't, like, commit. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are happening now with the cartoon book kind of situation coming in.
Oh, and the graphic
so they
novels.
Created a reluctant reader category to get a, kind of a high interest kind of a book that will get them to go to the very end of a book. And so I had been honored for that. My books were dragging reluctant readers all the way through to the end, which was really wonderful.
It seems that...
That's Mark Boyer, by the way.
Hello. That the attention span has decreased because of the instantaneous access to entertainment.
Yep.
I'm surprised that people can still go to the movies and sit, you know, for mm-hmm. for 2 hours. It's fascinating. But it really has to be something that catches the cultural phenomenon, like Harry Potter, for example. For anyone to sit and read a 600-page novel.
Mine are shorter, and I think that's one of the reasons that I was able to get that notice that I had been honored for getting reluctant readers to read all the way through. It's one of the keys is not to make it too ponderous. Mm-hmm. So that's why YA books can actually have a good readership among adults because they prefer a shorter book. And so we have a lot of crossover readers and young adults. And so we did, with Savannah, what it did for me is made me really go inward and try to work on my sense of justice and try to work out all the things that went wrong and all the things that I could make happen on my book. And I went out speaking a lot. And one of the places I went to was Florida. And I was signing and autographing books, and there was a huge crowd. And I looked up, and I saw this beautiful spirit, beautiful inside and out, totally connected. And her name is Lisa Nia.
But I can see her from here.
Wait, we're clairvoyant.
No,
we can see her ethereally.
And I remember you so clearly in that day, as if it happened just a moment ago. And what's fascinating to me is that I so wanted you to see me and notice me out of the crowd of so many people. And we did. We connected. And I so hoped when we were there, Lainey, that you could feel me. And you did. And this was in high school that I met you.
Right.
And which is amazing that after all these years, it's been 14, 15 years now. And it's just... That's the impact of you. That's how lasting it is.
Life
well,
is strange.
We talked a lot about our shared story. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
Well, we connected on a level, and then we didn't realize that we'd had the same, or at least I didn't, until she told me that she had suffered a very similar loss when Rob had been murdered, which is, again, a very different kind of death. You can't get any kind of closure with it, because you can't say it was their time. Somebody stole them. Somebody ripped them away. And so she and I started talking, and I wrote my number down, which I never do on my card, and I said, call me. And so she called me, and we just had so much in common and started, I knew that she had such a unique voice. I knew that she had a perspective that was one in a million. So I really encouraged her to write. And so she has. So I'm very, very proud of her.
Yeah, we're proud of her, too. We were going to have a little celebration, kind of like a birthday party, and spank her and give her, you know, a
oh, place.
That was the part we were looking forward to, but it just didn't materialize.
No.
We're an interesting crowd here in the Demons
of Decadence Bar. I think it's good that you can laugh at, you know, no matter what kind of hardship we've been through, you kind of get to a point where you just have to grab the light and keep on going and keep on living, and then also using the hard things in life, because I've never met anybody that hasn't had tragedy of one sort or another into their lives, and you can take it and use it when you're a writer, and that's one of the things that's so wonderful about this profession in particular, because you mold it and squeeze it and sort of make it work for you, where I think real life just gets away. It'll do its thing.
Now I'm going to rewind just a bit, because you were talking about the reluctant readers and getting people to read. I want to share something with you. When we did the movie The Saint, starring Val Kilmer, which is that turned out to be one of Lisa's favorite films, and when the Leslie Charteris, who created the character, took his name off of it.
Wow.
Because it was violated his character and his contract with Paramount so much. But I was hired to write the novelization of the screenplay. And the publisher, which is Simon & Schuster, said, well, we read your previous Saint book, Capture the Saint, and we didn't publish it because it was too literary for our audience, for today's readers, because Charteris wrote most of his, you know, he started writing in 1928 up until his passing in his 80s, and he said, today's audiences aren't that sophisticated, and your book is too sophisticated. Could you, and I said, do you mean dumb it down? And he said, yeah. So they said, take the same scene and write it three different ways. One, the way you would if you were doing it the way you want. Then dumb it down a little bit, and then take it down even further, and then we'll pick which one we want you to use. And they picked the middle one, which was much better. I mean, the final one was kind of like Dick, Jane, and Fluff in the Spot, you know. Run, Dick, run.
See, Dick create nuclear fusion in room temperature.
Yeah. So the novel that I wrote, which did very, very well, is written in the dumbed-down version of my style. And I did learn things that you already know because you've been doing this for quite a while, and that there's all these little tricks to keep them reading. Like the opening of a new chapter, don't make it a long paragraph. Otherwise, they go, oh, I'll close the book now and pick it up again tomorrow.
And don't.
So you start the next chapter with one sentence, two sentences. Yeah, all these little tricks to keep them reading. Lee Goldberg, who is my nephew, who's been doing quite well with his own series.
I think.
He co-wrote some books with, what's her name?
Ivanovich.
Yeah, Janet Ivanovich. He said, well, I've really learned even more that less is more. The less I do, the better they sell.
Yeah, Janet's the Stephanie Plum series.
Yeah, and they did about three or four books together. It did
something
well.
Else that's a trend these days is instead of reading, people listen.
Yes, thankfully, as I said just the other day on TikTok, I said, you'll like my book because I use many of your favorite words, and none of it's in cursive, so you can read it.
So audiobooks are huge.
Yeah, and plus, if you can't read and don't want to read, you can listen to it because they're in audiobooks. Right.
And you can absolutely read or listen to my books, The Christopher Killer, The Angel of Death, The Circle of Blood, and The Dying Breath on audiobooks.
So, and if you get it on Kindle, you can have the Kindle automated voice read it to you.
Oh, that's just lovely.
It's crazy. I did download the book so I could listen, and I listened to somebody read my words, and I went, okay, one sentence, I'm out. Because all I wanted to do was rewrite it. I just could not hear it. So I don't know how it sounds, but I've heard that it's very nice. But I just wanted to get my red pen out and start.
Revising your own material.
You have to learn how to let go. You have to get to a point where what you want to say is on the page, and it doesn't cause confusion. Gets the message across, and you kind of have to let it go because you're going to spend your entire life trying to make perfect out of something that's acceptable.
Yeah, well, perfectionists never get anything done. Perfectionism is an excuse not to finish things.
Now, I'm a perfectionist.
You know, I may not be writing novels or fiction, but as a software developer, you have to be able to let go and say, okay, I'm done and it works. And we'll let the clients say if they need any corrections or new features.
It's like Matt and I have often discussed the difference between news and editorials. News is just the facts, ma'am. Who, what, when, where, and why. Editorial is how you feel about those facts and different perspectives. I always think of Bob Dylan's line from Tangled Up in Blue, "We always did love the very same one. We just saw it from a different point of view."
And so, that is amazing.
Yeah, well, he's known for being good at lyrics.
Not at singing.
Perfect. I totally agree with you as a writer. I also have taught a Harvard class that was an online, just one on structure. And I can teach a good lesson, but it's very, very difficult for me to take my own advice.
Yes.
I'm a good one at dishing it out, but it's hard to move on. I think what Matt said was so correct, that it's an enemy. Perfectionism is just going to be an enemy of getting anything accomplished.
Yeah, you can always strive for excellence. You can't strive for perfection because perfection is endless.
Steinbeck's Excellence.
Yeah.
You want to have your head explode, try reading that.
I live on Steinbeck.
Yes, you do.
Yes,
I've read Steinbeck. I think that the way that I was able to use what happened to Savannah and then just reuse it and then learn, it was a jumping off point to the part that I'm most fascinated in, which is the mind of a killer, the different kinds of killers, the different motivations for killing. especially the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath, the narcissistic killer. There's just so much in there trying to really get motivations for these people, because I've written many, many mysteries. How I'm going to get into the killer, I have to know that killer first, actually before I start setting up a plot. So I need to know my villain. When I begin, that's who I know, and I know why he's doing what he's doing.
Villains don't see themselves as villains.
They do not.
No, we had
Hitler loved himself.
What did we have on?
He did.
That you know, a psychologist that studies the serial killers?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we had a couple of them.
I can't remember which, but we've had a couple of those on. And Dr. Robert Hare helped me with my book on that had two psychopaths in it. That's Headshot. He gets to plug one of his own books again. We had one of the psychopaths was born that way, and the other was made that way by a combination of abuse and a head injury. And so
wow.
And they were best friends.
Wow. That's right.
And, that is so fascinating.
And
it's
Dr.
a big controversy between born and, you know, you're born that way or the environment made you that way. But I think it's both and.
Yeah, Dr. Robert Hare, who's the world's leading expert on psychopaths, sociopaths, was very kind and generous in helping me with the book. Because then, you know, so I kind of thanked him in the book for, you know, being so generous in sharing information that applied to these two different gentlemen. And the one who was made a psychopath, he did do something that was very ethical, surprisingly, but it was self-serving, is he cut a deal with the prosecution in this murder case. He said, I will testify against the other two guys involved in this murder if you take the death penalty off and I'm eligible for parole in exchange for me testifying against truthfully about these other two guys. And the prosecution signed off on that. And when he got up on the stand, he said, I'm going to tell the truth. And the truth is, the other two guys did not know I was going to kill him. I did it on the spur of the moment, and I take full responsibility for it, and they are completely innocent of any, you know, collaboration in the murder, which was true. Of course, the prosecution was furious.
Of course.
Because they wanted to get the other
Because he had manipulated them, but he did tell the truth. He was the only one responsible for the murder. And so he got out on parole eventually, and he's written some rather successful books since then about Norse legends, of all things.
Of all things.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, I was just going to say how amazing it is that he would just, you know, walk right out of prison and write in a genre that is totally
different.
You know, opposite of his life and has nothing to do with his crimes.
Well, it was interesting in that one of his reasons for getting paroled is he'd become such a good Christian, and he guided so many people to Jesus in prison and out, that the first time he was up for parole, one of his family members was doing such a good job in prison, keep him there, which they did. Finally, they let him out because he'd been such an exemplary young Christian. The minute he was out, he wrote a book all about the Norse god Odin, who he had plighted fealty to. So it was another one of those scams, you know.
We have many of our guests are ex-convicts and talk about what it was like in prison and out of prison and what it was like being a criminal. You know, we've had drug dealers and a hitman. And
wow.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
One of the hitmen, but one hitman that I met in person, and he also had a cookbook out that you can get from Wild Blue Press.
Yeah.
He's passed away now. I said, do you ever feel, you know, did you ever feel bad about any of the people you killed? He goes, hell no.
Hell no.
Nope. They had it coming. You know, he was like a hired hitman. These were bad people. Yeah. If you see the movie.
At least bad in the eyes of his employer.
Yeah.
Right.
He was even a consultant on, what is the one where they shoot the guy and he starts to walk away. The way you're going, you know, we just killed you. That's either Casino or Goodfellas, one of the two.
Yeah.
And, they recreate the scene. One of his murders is in the movie, and he was a consultant on that scene.
Oh, my.
No, I didn't shoot him that way.
Wow.
Well, they have no empathy.
No empathy at all.
Isn't there, so they can't feel it. They can mimic it, but they can't feel it. And I was taking a class on this, and one of the things I found fascinating is how many people are psychopaths and narcissists that are in Wall Street and also in lawyers.
Yes.
They can really reach very high heights.
Mr. Wonderful on Shark Tank is a sociopath.
Is he?
Yep. There's a whole
violent
study of him on successful sociopaths. And if you don't go for this deal, you're dead to me, he says sometimes. And he means it.
Oh, my God. I mean, is there a book that you could recommend that talks about that?
He says so.
It's a TV show, dummy.
Oh, that's right. Like,
it's called parody.
Yes, that's probably true.
It's called a reality show.
You mean like The Apprentice?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Right.
I know that. I've been on TV.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Then why don't you know the difference?
I do know the difference.
Then why did you make your statement?
Because it is verifiable. He agrees with that.
It's verifiable?
Yes.
No kidding.
He confirmed it.
He's confirmed it.
Yes, it's not an argumentative point. But he's comfortable with it.
And it's not parody?
Well, in real life, he confirms that, yes, this is how he thinks. This is how he is.
This is one of those gray
moments. This is what we call...
Not everything is black and white.
This is what we call the difference between news and editorial.
Wow.
I'm not really an idiot. We just disagree sometimes.
Right. There's the gray.
Yes, there's a gray. I was listening to part of the podcast, and you were talking about gray, and I think there's a lot of this world is right in the gray zone. So it's pretty fascinating when you get inside somebody's brain, and when I'm teaching writing, you really do have to understand how they think, because what you said, girl, is in that, both of you are exactly right, that they make sense to themselves. And they're not going to see anything wrong with what they're doing. There might be things in their way, like, oh, I don't know, getting caught, but they're not going to feel bad. They're only going to feel entitled because people are toys to them. And I'm using this one step further now in my next book that I'm working on called Dragonfly Eyes. And that one's a paranormal mystery. So I've never done anything quite like that. But I'm using as a basis the BTK killer because I think he is one of the most clear-cut, narcissistic psychopaths that I have ever studied. He thanked, if you've ever seen where he was convicted, he's thanking the jury. I want to thank the jury for their wonderful service. Did you see that? He's like, I'd like to thank Plato for the wonderful food that was brought to me. Thank you very much. I would like to thank, he just won a freaking Academy
Award.
That's
crazy.
For those that aren't aware, BTK was bind, torture, and kill.
Dennis Rader.
Yeah, and we had his attorney on the show a couple times. And he said how strange it was on Christmas Eve that Rader comes into his office and wants to talk to him and says, I got all these dead bodies in my house of people I've killed, and I just wanted a lawyer to make sure I don't get the death penalty.
Wow.
And the lawyer did keep him from getting the death penalty. It's a fascinating story. And
I've read everything about it. I've read every page of that trial, and I've watched the trial. It's fascinating and horrifying at the same time, but my mind is always trying to follow a path on how he got there. He didn't have any of the classic, from what I can tell, the traumas that usually, what you were talking about, the book with the born that way, made that way kind of thing. He seems to have been born that way.
He just doesn't have the empathy chip.
Mm-mm. Yeah, the emotion.
It's devoid, completely missing.
As I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it on the air, what bookcase, I mentioned it to you in private conversation. There is a website for sociopaths run by sociopaths that I became aware of because they gave a negative review to one of my short stories that was written from the perspective of a psychopath. And
they gave you a negative review.
The negative review of the story. It didn't portray them accurately. Mm. And this kind of goes back to what Matt and I were just going back and forth about. There was one sociopath, the difference between psychopaths and sociopaths. Sociopaths said, I don't do anything wrong. I don't hurt anybody or do any of these stereotypical things because I learned early in life that if you do those things, bad things happen to you. The only person I care about is me. Therefore, I'm not going to do bad things to other people because it will affect my life negatively. They're very practical, which is why they say if you can get to someone who's sociopath prior to the age of 14, that you can tell that they will integrate that. You can tell them if you do these bad things to people, it'll bounce back on you. And they go, oh, okay, I won't do that then because it will hurt me.
Can you compare that, contrast that to a psychopath?
Psychopaths don't give a dump.
Yeah.
No, they don't care.
From what I've read, to like stretch that a little bit, is that a psychopath, I've heard this example, if you're in a bar and you piss off a psychopath, they might follow you and figure out where you live, and it might take 2 years to pay you back, but they will. Whereas a sociopath would have less control and might take a bottle and bash it on your head because they're mad. So there's a more impulsive side to the sociopath, and the psychopath is more cunning by their time, and they will get you. So yeah. That's how it was explained to me. I don't know if that fits the same thing. I don't know if anybody has positive.
Well, Dr. Robert Hare said the thing about Wall Street, about the number of sociopaths and even psychopaths on Wall Street. And I think the point I was getting at with Mr. Wonderful is if you have the proper perspective and you have these talents and abilities, it's the same energy. How do you use that energy? You can use it in a positive way for yourself and your family without hurting others, or you can be an ass and hurt other people. He doesn't hurt other people. He's made a wonderful career. He's very wealthy, provides great for his family, and he helps other people achieve success. That's all praiseworthy. So whatever we call it, condition or whatever, he has used that in a positive way rather than a negative way. So this is in praise of Mr. Wonderful, that it's like me with my brain damage. You know, have I used it in a positive way or a negative way? Hopefully I've used it in a positive way. As for Lisa, the jury's still out.
I definitely try to, with all the trauma I've experienced, I definitely try to help as many people as I can and share my past so that it can be an example for other people to kind of, you know, peer in and see what resonates with them so that they can use that and apply that in any way that is helpful to them and have a connection ultimately. And that's what I have with Elaine. She is... She and I have such a tremendously deep connection. And I think topics and the effects of things like murder and rape, they have such a profound effect on us all that it either makes or breaks you. It either kind of turns you into this monster or you take the step and make the choice to be resilient. Resilience doesn't just happen. We make choices and we choose to be.
Well, that's like the Bible says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. People who want revenge make themselves sicker and sicker, more sick all the time because it winds up owning them. That's why the advice was, let God handle it. Let life play itself out.
Well, I do kill them in my book.
Yes, you
so
do.
So everybody who's nasty to me in high school is dead. I use their names. You're dead. And I went to one very bad therapist, too, when I was very young. And he thought sleeping with me was a great way to up my spirit. So I use him in a book as well. I don't think you can get away with it as much. I've been writing for a very long time. But I will say that you can do that, and it feels super good to slip these little names in. And, you're dead. But it's very safe to do it on the page because nobody actually gets hurt. And you can sort of work some of your anger and rage and, I think, frustration. And I know that with Lisa and Mia, she's had a troubled background and was able to turn that around, break the chain, and just share this beauty. Plus, her poetry is just unbelievably good. So it's been a joy to watch her bloom and blossom, where a lot of people would shrivel and just be gone. And she's just done the opposite. So that's, again,
it's interesting that you can have two kids in the same family that go through the exact same experiences. Again, this is like news and editorial, and yet one of them arises and survives it, and another one totally crumbles or becomes exactly like the people who persecuted them.
Absolutely.
And that's, they don't know why that is. I mean, the two people in the same situation are going to see it from their own point of view.
Burrow, yeah. To each their own according to their gifts.
Yes. Some people are gifted with more than others. A sense of shame.
So says Mr. Spock.
Yes.
Well, and he wasn't the baby doctor.
No wonder I loved it. I love Spock.
Yes. Well, he always spoke highly of you, too.
Well, you know, that was a comment to James T. Kirk that he said in a crisis.
Yeah, well, Baha'u'llah says the sense of shame is some people have and others don't. Some people have it to a certain extent. Others have a great deal of it that keeps them from doing things that are reprehensible. Mm-hmm. And others don't have that, you know.
There are other factors. Some, like me, can become comfortable with the pain. And it becomes a part of your life. And after a time, not having the pain seems unthinkable.
It becomes welded to your identity.
And with the pain, you can wear it on your sleeve as a badge of honor. Look how well I'm doing with my pain. And it becomes part of you.
So you overcame that?
No.
To an extent, at least.
I did not. I met a couple of friends, Matt and another fellow that is a friend of ours, Paul, and they dragged me, kicking and screaming, out of the muck.
You know, that's empathy.
Yes, but then it wasn't, just like, you know, breaking addiction. You have to want to.
A choice to be resilient.
You have to want to. You're throwing somebody into rehab. Just because you're throwing them into rehab isn't necessarily going to work because they have to want to get better. And it took a while for me to want to get better.
There you go.
What made you decide to write children's and young adults' novels?
I think one of the biggest reasons for me was because my mother is a children's author. So I grew up listening to authors come to the house and discuss and talk, and I was absorbing a lot. I think it felt familiar to me, and I had children, and it was, you know, I was relating to people that age. I was sort of the house where all the kids came because I fed everybody. And so I was around children a lot, but as I've grown and gotten older, and I mean not just high, but grown, I've gotten bigger. I've grown into doing more complex ideas so that I have more space, and that's why I'm sort of walking into a adult. So one of the things that I did, a story for What Doesn't Kill Her, and it's the story of resilience in women. I have a story in that, and it's about a really dark time in my life, and that's got a lot of attention and buzz. So for me, that sort of let me open up and move with language a lot more and with more complicated ideas. But I began where it was familiar. I think that's why I chose where it was familiar. And because when Savannah died, I was quite young. And that seemed like a natural place to start to process what happened to her. I was so 100% for the police and how the courts worked. The Honorable Robert Fitzgerald said in her case that it was one continuous act, and that's why Robert Lloyd Sellers was going to be put away, and that was the end of it, or so I thought. And then the Supreme Court of California heard the case. We went back to square one, and I was young, and it almost in a way stopped me, I think. But trauma, I was 21. It was just defining who I was. I really, really mentally had a hard time moving forward because we were very close. And I just realized how fragile life was, so that's a good lesson. But there's somebody that can be lurking, because Robert Lloyd Sellers hid in her closet while she talked to her mother on Mother's Day. He just waited for her. And I got afraid of closets. I was like, where, if I can't see something, somebody might be hiding there. And I had a lot of fear. So I started, I think, there, because I was young when I began writing. And then I've seen this evolution. And now I'm feeling like I can really expand my wings. And that's why Dragonfly Eyes is going to be, I'd say, either new adult or adult. It's sort of bridging that. They've got a new category now, which is called new adult. So it's sort of riding that line. And I have, one of the ways you can tell the difference is, in a young adult novel, the protagonist and all of the characters are going to be young adult. When you're dealing with new adult or adult, your cast of characters can be much older, although your protagonist is probably young. So I'm running into that category because, again, there's a little bit more freedom, a little more room to do complexities, whereas you're going to be a lot more linear if you're doing a YA, and more linear still if you're doing younger than that. And another reason is they're faster to write. So this novel has taken me forever because I didn't realize that building a world was going to be this hard, because I love Harry Potter and I just was like, J.K. Rowling is my hero. I'm going to do something and I'm going to make up this world. And I started going into all kinds of religious beliefs and faiths and what happens when you die. And these are rabbit trails that fascinate me. So I can spend forever learning about how this particular religion sees death and that particular religion will see death. And I didn't want to go down any prescribed path, so I sort of made it my own. And so that took a long time to pull all this together. And I'm really excited. It's something really different.
You know, we talked about Burroughs' nephew, Lee Goldberg, who collaborates with Ivanovich, who writes the Stephanie Plum novels. And if you've ever read any of those, she creates a world, but she saves time. She only has a few specific items that are the fiction. And the rest of it is the little section of New Jersey that the character lives in that she knows. So she doesn't have to invent anything about the location and the people that live there because they're real. And she only has to invent the four or five characters and stick them into that world.
Which is exactly what I've done. When I did the forensic mysteries, which were specifically going into forensics, I went and did I didn't perform them, but I did weigh hearts and brains and that kind of thing. But I was in an autopsy room with forensic pathologists, so I could actually see what happened, because TV would paint such a very, clever and quick solution. We'll just spray this we're going to spray this aerosol, and then we're going to find the fingerprints on their neck. Well, that doesn't exist. It's very, very advanced. If they have it, this is not what most people are going to ever see. So what's it like in the nuts and bolts world? And then I got to see that and see how much art is involved in what they see and how they go through this very difficult process with bodies that come in all kinds of states of decay. I really want to give a big shout out to people that are in this field. It's a tough, tough field to be in, and you have to be mentally together to do it. You see a lot of tragedy. And I couldn't, of course, go in there if there's any question of all the foul play, because that would really complete the whole scene. So I just would come in on naturals, but there would be some that were unattended, and they sort of just had to do that. But I learned a lot from watching, and I learned a lot from studying, but I could not help ask myself what happens next. And that's what got me into what I assumed was going to be way easier than it was, which is building a world in the afterlife that's like spirits that walk the earth. So to do that, obviously we don't have billions of spirits that we're bumping into. So where do they go? Why are most gone? Who stays? Why do they stay? Then you have to get down to even how do they move? Are they flying? Are they walking? And I had to go through what I did is a lot of folklore. I went way, way back in time and just built up.
Let me give you a book recommendation. There's a book called Not Every Sea Hath Pearls. I can't remember who wrote it, but it's fascinating. It's all on that topic. It does tell the story of these are all little true stories, of this woman who looks out her window in the snow, and she sees these soldiers trying to repair a truck that is broken down. And they don't seem to be making any progress. They just keep working on this. And so she makes a bunch of hot cocoa, and she goes out there to give these guys some hot cocoa, and there's nobody there. There's no truck there. There's no footprints. And she's totally mystified.
Matthew Louise Albee.
And what's her name?
Matthew Louise Albee.
Wrote Not Every Sea Hath Pearls.
Yeah.
Any of it, the explanation that was, what a wonderful human being. This, explanation was given was, these guys were working on the truck, and they got bombed, and they were killed instantly. They didn't realize they'd been killed instantly, and so they were still working on that truck until a point realized that they had indeed passed away. But the point that she's seeing them in kind of a spiritual perception, they're still working on that damn truck, even though the truck's no longer there and neither are they.
Well, so that would be called, because I've also been trained as a ghost hunter. So this is the places you go when you're a writer.
From, yep, no kidding. You go to all sorts of places. If you want to take time to write a book, try writing true crime. They give you like,
right.
You sign the contract and it says a year. It can be 6 years because you may be doing several years of research, tracking things down. And even then, there'll be something that someone will say. It happened to be just the other day when I was discussing this case with one of my sources. And I said, well, I'm going out there that so-and-so went back and killed this person. So they went, oh, no, not him. He's a pussy. It was his uncle. And his uncle was big and had muscles, and he was always the muscle guy. I didn't know that. All this time I've been working on the book, I was assuming person A was actually the murderer that was never caught. And this person just nonchalantly says, oh, no, it was the uncle.
Oh, my goodness. See, there's surprises. So I was talking to a woman, and she had her daughter had been killed, and a stray bullet with gangs, you know, it killed her daughter, so she had to take care of the grandchildren. And so I was talking to her, and I said, the reason why murder is so hard, which I alluded to earlier, is there's no comfort in it. Somebody was ripped, and I don't understand how that fits in whatever comes next. And she said that her grandmother was actually sort of a seer and had visions and could do seances and talk to the other side. And she told her that there's a date that the day you're supposed to be born and the day that you're supposed to die. And if somebody interrupts that natural date, your death date, then you're bound to wander until your death date rolls around. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's fabulous. So now I have to rewrite. I was like, so I was like, damn it. I gotta go all the way back to church.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? The time of our show is coming to an end, whether we're supposed to or not. We may be wandering the airwaves. That's one thing about AM signals. They never go away. They just keep bouncing. And that's why a station can be off the air and you can still hear them.
How about that?
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you both. It's been wonderful. Lisa, love you. And I appreciate this opportunity to talk about my class and how I got here. So thank you.
An honor. When your book is ready to come out, get a hold of Burl, and we'll have you back on.